Hello and welcome, everyone. We are back from the pure abyss for yet another episode of MTG Potpourri. And Adam, who is joining me, you chastised me last time for not doing introductions. And apparently some people commented also that they want introductions. So I'm going to hand it off to you to be that the dad, the old guy at the parties that likes to introduce people to other people.
Well, thanks, Tom, my fellow podcastee. I'll accept that as you were right. That was the most roundabout, long-winded, you were right, we should do introductions that I've had in a long time. And what's really disappointing about this episode right now is Conley's not here. And this is the first one that you didn't start off with another very special episode. So the Conley would have been here for it,
you dropped it. That's exactly why I didn't do it, because now he's going to, for the rest of his life, you know, he missed the one episode where I didn't say it because I knew he wasn't here yet. And so, I mean, we're kind of restarting. You know, we're coming back. It's been a month. A lot of stuff has happened pretty much everywhere.
Everything.
And I'm just killing time because I'm still watching out of the corner of my eye how to make a pocket crossbow through my Facebook ad here.
You are still the maniac, and that's why we love you.
It has sucked me in.
So this is a two-man show, listeners, if you haven't picked up on yet. So if you like the last one, hopefully you'll like this one. I'm just going to play off of Tom. So Tom's got a list, and we've kind of had a little bit of back and forth. Like, I threw out some ideas, but Tom's got a list of stuff that we're going to cover, and I have no idea what's coming.
So, Adam, you totally didn't introduce either one of us. I mean, you introduced me,
and I said, Tom, my fellow podcaster.
No, we introduced each other. Is that like the life story thing or just like our names?
Just our names.
Oh, okay. I feel better. I thought we had to like give our life story every single episode, and that seemed long and introspective and something. Yeah.
No, it's just awesome. That way people know whose voice is what, because like the life story stuff is in all our Twitter bios and whatever. Like they can see who we are from all the links. This is just more of like, hey, this is my voice. I'm Adam. That's your voice. You're Tom. Yeah. Conley's voice isn't here, so tune in later. Maybe you'll hear him.
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear, because apparently on his stream one or two nights ago, he did the It's everywhere. If you have not somehow seen an ALS Ice Bucket Challenge video, you apparently don't have internet access. But he apparently did one live on a stream, but he didn't think it through. Apparently he did it in his bedroom. I'm assuming that's where his streaming setup is. Probably not the best place to dump an entire thing of water is in your room.
I have no words to describe my thoughts to that. Other than that sounds incredibly dumb.
You want me to ambush you for this podcast, so we're going to jump right into it. It's been roughly a month since we podcasted, and a lot of stuff has happened. We were kind of chatting through some of the things like Gen Con, the Pro Tour. But obviously, on this show, we only ever talk about Magic, so I'm going to jump right into the actual cards that are going to come out. So actual I want to talk Magic. Actual Magic. So Cons of Tarkir, which sounds like a Star Trek movie title to me.
I may have had a Wrath of God altered to a Wrath of Khan with Kirk screaming.
Oh, that would be phenomenal. I had the Kirk screaming Khan as my ringtone for about a year in clinic, and every time it would come off, it was incredibly loud. It was fun to see people jump every time I got a phone call. You know, because you know, it's quiet in the clinic. I was like, God! Yeah, like, you know it's your phone, because who else's phone would be screaming Khan at you? You know, at least 3 or 4 times a day. So Cons of Tarkir, we don't have a ton of cards, Adam, but there's a couple of things returning. One of these mechanics I am obviously very excited about. And we also obviously have some new keywords every single time. So can you jump me? I mean, Morph is the one that we've seen coming back. And
yeah, Morph's returning.
Yeah, I was curious, and I want to get your input. I was curious to see kind of more from the pro side, is at least from a casual side, I have always really liked Morph. It's always nice that you have the option at least to plop out a 2/2 vanilla creature.
Yeah, I mean, Morph is one of those mechanics. I'm sure Conley would have a slightly different angle to this, but it's one of those really weird intersections of you get some pseudo randomness, right? Morph is one of those things you might have some ideas, you can guess by the color, but the fact that you can literally just play any Morph creature face down for 3 colorless means Grey Ogres are, you know, at least 3 toughness is going to be a critical line and limited. Theoretically, if there's enough Morph going around, and the way Morph interacts at a competitive level is it's additional unknown information. It's hidden information. So it's hidden in your hand. Now you get a creature in play that theoretically can be equipped with things, can be enchanted, is a live threat to kill you, but you still don't actually know what it is. And so there's a lot of gamesmanship that can kind of come from that. So it's exciting on those levels, that additional randomness and the additional kind of play you get from it. But what's also really kind of a big downside from it is how it plays out also at the professional level. So at the end of a game, you have to reveal the morph cards that you played.
Really? So that's the official, I guess, obviously I never played with these in a quote tournament level. So you have to reveal all the creatures at the end of the game?
Whatever face down morphs are there, you do have to reveal. And so the obvious reason for that is so you just don't play anything as a face down morph and then just like scoop.
Okay.
You know, because like, again, it's still hidden. So the opponent has no way, you have no way to validate that your opponent actually played an actual morph creature, because nothing's revealed. Nothing about the back of a card or the card in a sleeve tells you it's a morph unless you actually see the mechanic on the front of it. So it's one of those things where I think there's going to be some, you know, unfortunate judge calls and some learning lessons, but it's one of the mechanics that I think people thought was a little too complex to ever come back. But I think because of all of the randomness that players like, the mana smoothness, like I can just at least get a creature on the board and block with. Like, worst comes to worst, this card I can just like get it down and do something with. And the fact that it has some additional play and gamesmanship at the constructed levels, I think is why they decided to bring it back.
Well, it's kind of drafting.
I'm looking for, yeah.
It's like a drafting wet dream, and at least you always have something you can plop out on the table.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a 2/2 for 3 isn't that exciting. It's not, you know, it's not really passing the vanilla test, which is a really good marker. And I would suspect that a generic morph creature isn't going to be as good, given that anybody has access to them. So I think, you know, I would assume that limited will be balanced around the fact that everybody will have access to 2/2s for 3. So I'd be shocked if they were really good as a 2/2 for 3. So I'm really, that's what makes me excited is all of the lessons that R&D has learned over the past, you know, over a decade since Morph was first introduced and given in the game. It was like one of the last mechanics before the switch to the new card frame. Like, Morph isn't even in Modern except for Time Spiral. And that was, you know, that block was so complicated. It like made them hit the reset button on complexity. So I'm really excited to see what they do with it now that they have the new paradigm of how they handle complexity, what they do with it at rarities. Like, I'd be shocked if Morph was at common. So I'm not looking forward to that, to seeing that being the case. I think we've only seen one rare so far with Morph on it. One of the previews from Gamescom.
Yeah. The Thousand Woods. That's kind of what told us that Morph was coming back.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's okay. If it's not at common, I'm just gonna be really sad because I want some for my cube. Morph is a great mechanic for limited.
And just, it feels like a very, again, we don't know the professional view since it would potentially add some complexity to the tournament scene, but maybe, I mean, at the very high levels, it shouldn't be a major issue. I assume they would have figured this out the last time it was in a major block.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I'm looking forward to is I'm going to assume there's going to be some morphs that are designed with constructed in mind. So while they may not necessarily be dominant and limited, there's going to be some morph, you know, interaction in constructed, you know, for sure. This is, again, my speculation, and I'm really looking forward to a kind of moment at the Pro Tour, very similar to the Miracles deck when Alexander Hain won for Pro Tour Avacyn Restored. Is that there's going to be some moment where one player thinks a face down card is one card and plays around it that way when it's actually another card, and it just sets up that long game of, you know, is the information that I'm assuming right or not? And forks and decisions that come off of that. I think it's going to be really interesting to see that play out at the best level.
Now, from your, I just kind of want to kind of get your thought on this. If we're going way back to when, you know, say, you know, Planar Chaos, you know, Onslaught, that block, when we first saw Morph out, do you personally like the Morph creatures where in some way you would play it out as Morph, you know, say pay 3 mana, then the Morph cost would be less than its actual casting cost, but often they wouldn't have any sort of coming into play ability? Or do you like some, and I'm just going to give you an example of what I'm talking about here. We'll go way back to Achroma, Angel of Fury, Planar Chaos. You know, its casting cost was 3 red and 5 colorless, where you play it for morph, and then the morph cost was just 3 and 3 colors and 3 red. So in some ways, you were overall paying more, but you could kind of space out the cost to it. Or do you like ones like Thousand Winds, where theoretically you are paying the morph cost is actually more than its casting cost, but then you get some sort of typically very positive or cool ability when it flips up.
I mean, it's kind of hard because really it's a combination of all the different things that work together. Like one of my favorite morphs is Shaper Parasite. So it's a blue common from Planar Chaos. It's in my cube and it's, you know, it's a gray ogre. It's a blue card. And you can unmorph it for a two and a blue, and it gives target creature either -2/+2 until end of turn, or +2/-2 until end of turn.
It was blue creature kill. You don't get that.
Yep. So it's one of those things where, you know, obviously this is a very Planar Chaos card. Like, what? Like, it's doing some weird stuff. But it fills a really niche role where it's a 2/3 when it flips up, so it can fight other 2/2s, which are pretty, you know, it's a pretty average size in the cube. So it's got 3 toughness, which is pretty good for blocking. It can kill other aggressive creatures. So typically you can set up like a blocking 2-for-1 with it, assuming no removal gets involved after that point from your opponent. Those are the kind of cards that I think makes Morph shine, is when you have, when all the numbers line up in a way where you get much more than you would expect out of the package. So like something like 1,000 wins is nice because it's basically mana smoothing. Like, okay, well, I can play this as a 3/3/2 if I'm being pressured and I'm mana light. I can play it as just like a big, dumb flying guy because those guys win limited. But if I play it early and I flood out, I can get this really great effect that helps me catch up. It can help me get back in the game. It can set up a great block where like I kill something they weren't expecting because it flies. So all of a sudden after attackers are declared, boom, you can unmorph and you've got a flyer basically jumps up in the air and blocks something. Like those, that type of interaction, I think, is what makes morph really cool. So obviously like cheaper morph costs and more efficient bodies make that happen a lot more often. They kind of make those cards stand out. So those are the morphs I like. Like, I think like things like a Chroma Angel, Angel of Fury is, you know, it's just like cost spreading. Like you're really not going to surprise your opponent that often with an Achroma. I mean, you will, but you know, it's just different. It's like, you can almost just play it as it is. And like with all of its protection abilities, like it's just not that, you know, it's just generally not that interesting always on its own, compared to when you have like something like a common or uncommon that you know you're going to see in almost every draft, and learning to maximize those smaller interactions.
I was just pulling up the list of all the cards with morphing. There, I didn't know how many there was. There's a boatload of morph cards out there, and
you can thank you can thank Legions for that.
it was a great ability, but I mean some of the classes like Bane of the Living, one of my personal Chrome Shell Crab. Oh god, some of these were great. Like you said, for and especially when people had a rough idea of what you had in your deck, but they didn't know which one that was. And, you know, do you play around it? Do you not? I mean, some of these are just amazing for, I guess, psychological warfare during these games.
Playing random value morph guys, like the morph that's actually just Gush in a blue deck in Commander, is unreal because everybody just assumes it's a Willbender because it's always a Willbender. And you just randomly get people to play way differently because like, well, I can't shoot this spell at Stibbs because he's just going to Willbender it at me or somebody else. So I'm going to do this instead or point that ability elsewhere. So like those morphs that have a really unique ability and can make opponents, you know, it's that leveling game, you know, when you can make an opponent's think about the cards differently than what they actually are. That's like the main value of a morph.
Yes, so Paint Me is very excited to have that coming back because that made me instantly more excited for this set than maybe even a couple of other ones in this block already. So I would give them two big thumbs up on that one. So Anna, how about you? We have two new, are they keywords? I will never know the difference between these things, but we have Prowess and we have Raid. Is there one that you want to talk about first that has you the most excited?
Let's talk about Raid.
Because is it possible for anybody who's over the age of 18 to hear the word prowess and not think sexual prowess? Is that not the first thing that jumps into your mind?
Yes, Tom. Martial prowess. Clearly, you do not watch enough action flicks. So, yeah. Raid.
depends what you define by action flicks.
Action.
If they're on Cinemax after midnight, I watch a lot of action flicks.
So you like shower scenes. Got it.
I do. I like the Red Shoe Diaries, 1-18.
So,
you're old if you get that reference, the Red Shoe Diaries.
So Raid is very similar to to what we've seen twice before, thanks to, I think, Magic 2012, very similar to Bloodthirst. So raid works, and basically it's just a check, and it says, hey, did you attack with a creature this turn? If you did, you get this bonus. And so the reason I want to talk about raid is because raid is one of those things that basically it does two things. It encourages players who are learning the game to attack. And that's something I'm actually not very good at, because I play a lot of Commander and I'm not used to thinking about it as attacking as aggressively as I should in Limited. And mechanics like raid, things like Annihilator, creatures like that are just big, but also just randomly have this must attack every turn. Like those things are really important for newer players because it gets them to do what they need to do to win. It's arguably a little bit of hand holding, but it kind of gently nudges them down this path of, hey, look, if I attack, I get closer and closer to winning. If I'm attacking, I'm making my opponent play the way I want them to play. If I'm attacking, I'm forcing them to use their tricks defensively, not offensively. And so things like raid, Mardu Heart Piercer is just it's a 2/3 for 4. It's not that exciting, but the fact that it can shock something after you attack means you can throw like a random morph you're not going to flip away into a 2/3 or a 2/4, and then the Heart Piercer comes down and finishes it off. And so for a 1/1 trade, you've gotten rid of that shocking and killing a random creature works out great. Just shocking your opponent is always a good thing. It's just one of those cards that shows you the value of applying pressure, and it does it in just a very natural way. It's like, hey, I want to be attacking. This card wants me to attack. What can I attack with? Even if you're just attacking with something small and you feel like you're just going to kill one of their other small guys, like that feels good. And it reinforces that attacking is good.
The one thing that I guess I would potentially like this a little bit less than Bloodthirst is at least Bloodthirst had added in this option where, say you did have a blocker, you could really decide, do I block potentially lose a creature in a very unfavorable exchange to prevent Bloodthirst? Or do I, take a small amount of damage and gamble they don't have a Bloodthirst card in their hand? With Raid, as soon as they've declared their attack, I mean, it seems like the decision has already been made. There's no way for me as the defending player to try and stop this, outside of, tapping a creature before combat or somehow else removing them for the ability to attack.
Yeah, and I'm okay. I'm actually really okay with that, because one of the most frustrating things about Bloodthirst was how you could be in a position where like you have like a really great Bloodthirst deck, but if your opponent just curves out perfectly with blockers and removal, like literally you just cannot get into the game because your dudes are always undersized. You're not able to punch through for damage. Trying to cast creatures on the curve isn't effective when you're trying to face down 0/4s and 1/3s and things like that. So like raid is one of those mechanics where even if you're behind, it encourages you to still attack, to create those opportunities for value. And your opponent, the flip direction works too. Like if your opponent is clearly attacking you with what looks like a really bad attack, that should tip you off that there's probably raid, that there's some sort of trick coming. It's one of the things where raid can function as like basically a sorcery speed post-combat trick. Something that bounces or something that deals additional damage, like the Heart Piercer. It's the thing where it adds that layer of complexity, and again forces your opponent to really think about what they should do in response to an attack. And I think that's still worth it.
I'm just blowing my mind. I'm still thinking about the Red Shoe Dyers with David Duchovny. Did you realize that he was doing X-Files and the Red Shoe Dyers at the same time? That they actually overlapped for about 4 or 5 years. That blows my mind.
I had no idea.
He was in two huge shows at the same time. One being the X-Files and one being what amounted to softcore pornography. I think that's fairly impressive. So maybe, Adam, I'm going to share what Raid does just in case maybe people haven't seen or read what it does to compare with Bloodthirst. So if we take Mardu Heart Pierce, which is our one example so far, and is it a common? Uncommon. So 3 and a red, it's a creature, human archer. It's a 2/3. And just says Raid, when this creature enters the battlefield, if you attacked with a creature this turn, it deals 2 damage to target creature or player. I guess I agree with you, or at least if you are maybe new to deck building and trying to put together a deck, at least hopefully you should be able to make these interactions happen on a regular basis. Obviously, if they're playing a lot of creature kill or other shenanigans, and if you don't have a creature on board, you're not be able to trigger this. But like you said, with Bloodthirst, a lot of times you could never actually get that to trigger for the entire game. And these are still, I guess if you look at them, if you're not triggering the ability, they're fairly bad for their cost. Because if you don't get the raid ability on this guy, he's a 4-mana 2/3.
That's Adam not very exciting.
No, I was like, he either died or he's just really unexcited about Mardu Heartpiercer if he comes out by himself.
Yeah. I mean, again, it still has that Bloodthirst limitation. Like, you want to be attacking. But in this case, at least if you attack with anything, you still get it. That's what I like about it. So let's talk about Prowse.
Sorry, I giggle every time you say that because there's just no other way to think about that.
So Prowse. Prowse is a keyword, and it says, whenever you cast a non-creature spell, this creature gets +1/+1 until end of turn. Aw, yeah.
It gets bigger, is what it says, but it doesn't last forever.
So the card that we saw this on is a really interesting one, Jeskai Elder. So it's a 1 and a blue for a 1/2, which isn't that exciting. It's got prowess, so you cast spells, it gets pumped up, but it has the... it has the looter ability. It has the combat damage looter ability. So whenever it deals combat damage to a player, you draw a card. If you do that, you discard a card. So it's one of those things where if you've got great tricks, if you have tricks that like make like a creature jump in the air so it can attack and jump over defenders, or it's unblockable and didn't turn, things like that will turn this guy into a monster where you could punch for 2 or 3 damage. You keep your handful of relevant threats, and by the time this guy is just so outclassed or you're out of tricks to really make him shine, and prowess, you know, isn't really a thing anymore. Ideally, you have like, you know, your 5/5 flyer online, or you know, your big finisher. You've dug down to it much faster than if you didn't have any card draw.
Yeah, I was kind of. Yeah, it seems. I'm curious to see what else this is on, because I feel like for. This seems like a more advanced ability for a lot of new players. Initially, if you read that, if you did know the power of looting, this seems really unexciting. Because it's interesting that you don't get the bonus for prowess by casting creature spells. It says specifically when you cast a non-creature spell. And in your mind, I mean, do you ever really see this outside of, like, I don't know, Storm decks or other really odd combo decks? Are you ever really going to be triggering this more than, like, maybe once or twice in a turn?
I mean, it turns things like Divination. You know, if you've got like 1 or 2 of these guys down and you know, you sit on a Divination for a turn and then suddenly you have 5 mana, you cast Divination, triggers prowess, and you draw into something else that triggers prowess again, like suddenly, you know, you can really deal some damage. And I like that this is non-creature. I'm wondering if they tried whenever you cast any spell.
Clearly it was a little strong if they did it that way.
Yeah, because then, like, literally, like, you just, like, cast your creatures pre-combat, and, like, your dudes are just bigger every turn while you're building an army behind them. And prowess can lead to more prowess, and, you know, it gets really obnoxious. I could see that. But with non-creature, like, the ability to set up, like, insta-speed card draw suddenly just seems really good when you've got a bunch of prowess hanging around. Like, okay, you've declared blockers, great. Well, I'm going to cast this 2-mana spell that just draws me a card. Oh, look, I drew another combat trick, and I just, like, mow down half your army. Like, it's deceptively powerful when you have the right deck for it. So I suspect that this kind of leads me to believe there's going to be some cool tricks. Maybe the return of, like, a really nice common or uncommon instant speed card draw spell. Just something that that can help make prowess kind of one of those dangerous things where it's like, do they have the spell that makes prowess really good, or is it still just all right?
Yeah, it seems like a very blue ability to me. It seems like it tells me as a deck constructor coming new to this set that, I mean, do you see this as a card where you have 1 or 2 cards with prowess out and then say like a blue deck where you have a couple of creatures and you have a boatload of other stuff to protect it and you sort of ride this thing to victory? Or are you seeing this more as on a lot of smaller creatures, hopefully you bust out a couple of combat tricks and just win by getting, you know, an extra 3 damage every turn by playing one combat trick?
I mean, if you play it every turn, you're going to run out. I think it's one of those things where it's encouraging you to attack and present your opponent with difficult decisions. You know, if you're attacking into a 2/2 with your Jeskai Elder, you know, you can block with your 2/2. Like you know if the Jeskai player is going second, you know, on third turn you play a Morph Tom, and I untap with my active Jeskai Elder, and you're tapped out. You've got a 2/2. I've got a 1/2, and I just attack, and it's like, do you block? And that's the kind of question that I think is going to be really, really interesting to answer. Because if you block, like maybe I don't have a trick, or is it worth wasting a trick at that point to kill a random morph that you played? Because you know, if I, you know, if I don't know what morph you've played and you don't know what tricks I have, like to newer players, like the decision may seem simpler. Like, well, I'm not going to throw my 2/2 away. Like, okay, just draw and discard a card. I can give you one. That's fine. But for, you know, but at the higher level of the game, especially like Pro Tour draft, like that's a question that's going to come up. And I think that the right answer to that is going to be really hard to know. And it's going to make, you know, that's what's going to be exciting about it is trying to predict what your opponent's doing, which is typically going to be trying to predict what you're doing. You know, that's where I think prowess kind of sits in. It's one of those things where is this situation where two or three prowess guys are attacking, one combat trick suddenly also pumps half the attackers. That's a really dicey situation.
It does feel like another side of the same die of design space that gave us morph, where again, it makes you do combat decisions where you don't know what the opponent has. I like the idea of giving it. In some ways, you feel like you're gambling again. And that's what Magic is initially about. When you first started playing the game, this was gambling and Satanism, at least when I first started playing Magic. So I like when they bring back this where I have to try to read my opponent's mind. You're trying to absorb all this information from, you know, game one, if you're playing some sort of actual tournament or draft. Using that future knowledge to ensure your victory seems very cool. Where it feels like if you start seeing prowess cards, I mean, are people going to start, you know, on their little sheets of paper writing down all the non-creature spells you play and their casting costs so they can try to guess if you have open mana what you could potentially have? That seems kind of cool to me. Mm-hmm. We got a lot of mileage out of what I must like for. And for me, as a kind of a budget player who doesn't get a lot of the really expensive dual lands, I am always excited when they give me coming to tap lands that provide three different types of mana, especially when they're enemy colors. That just gives me just big old hard on. I was like, get high fives for that one. Thank you. They're at the uncommon stage.
Yeah, I mean, when the Allied Arc cycle came out during Shards of Valara, I mean, everybody kind of figured we'd have the enemy wedge colors at some point. So, you know, I don't think anybody was surprised to see these.
I'm still happy, and that they're uncommon. I never know when they just might decide to stab me in the kidney and make these random cards rare for these multicolor lands.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see if these are the only lands we're going to see, because we're, I mean, it seems like Standard's about to speed up slightly, maybe slow down. I don't know. I wish Conley was here to give us his take. I mean, the shock lands make formats faster. So all the dual lands from Ravnica that could come into play untapped if you paid life, with those going away, it seems like the format might slow down slightly. But also the fact that we just got all the enemy colored pain lands means like enemy colored aggro decks still have a really great mana base that starts with four enemy colored pain land, four mana confluence. So you're still paying for speed. I'd be curious to see how many of these new wedge lands at uncommon show up in constructed. Cause if there's going to be a three color deck or some sort of four color value deck, like I assume these would have to be involved in some way.
Yeah. I'm curious to see that when people receive these, is it more the kind of budget casual player where it's like, hey, I can actually get a bunch of these for a few dollars and not gonna make my deck any faster, but as a casual player, I'd much rather have my deck be slightly slower since you're just playing for fun and actually be able to cast the cards that I have versus maybe having one expensive pain land or Ravnica duel that doesn't really do a whole lot for my deck.
I mean, if you're playing a wedge colored commander, like you need to just jam one of these in. I mean, just perfect mana fixing from one card is just always great. Like it's worth coming into play tapped, untapped, and be able to cast anything in your deck.
Now we have had one artifact spoiled for Khans of Tark here. It's not on.
Was it spoiled
It was on the big poster where people zoomed in. I don't know where this poster was released, but the card is shown on a poster. So I was actually able to see an image that seems legit. That this is now, I mean, it's been spoiled because it's incredibly small, but they zoomed in, you can read the card. So I think this one is official.
Yeah, I'm always a little leery of those zoom ones. It sounds like it's one of the retailer posters that's supposed to go up soon and somebody looked at it sooner. But go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, no, I was trying to actually pull up the picture of the poster that I saw or kind of what the source of this is.
Well, I'll go ahead and read the alleged card.
I will find it.
Dragon Throne of Tarkir, it's a 4-mana legendary artifact equipment. So it's the first time that you wear a chair.
Yeah, and that's where I went down the Reddit like toilet bowl, because I was like, that is, like you said, it was, everybody's talking about, you know, you equip a chair. I was like, well, that is somewhat interesting. You equip something that basically makes you sit there, and that's, we'll read the card, but that's
what it
promotes.
Yeah, that's what it literally does. Equip creature has defender and the ability to mana, tap other creatures you control, gain trample, and +X/+X until end of turn, where X is this creature's power. So basically, it turns one of your dudes into a combat trick that you can do every turn. So the bigger the dude on the throne, the more powerful the rest of the dudes become. What I find really interesting about this warrior, it costs 3 to equip. So you need you would need a whopping 9 mana to drop it, equip, and use it as a trick that turn. Assuming the creature you equipped it to had haste, because you brought it into play through some other means that didn't involve the 9 mana you're already spending, or was probably already out.
So you just want, chairs are, to me, are inherently slow, Adam. I would not expect a chair to be fast.
This chair is glacial. What strikes me about this is I'm really curious if this is really the card. And the reason I say alleged card is because it just strikes me as a little strange, because you can use it defensively. Because effectively you could block with all your dudes and then tap your guy and pump him up. Like, I guess theoretically, like, you know, the king on the throne helps your army defensively or offensively. But I feel like it feels like so much of the set seems geared towards attacking, moving forward, conquest, you know, war, that it just seemed like, you know, it felt like one of those things where, like, you would have to tap it for attacking creatures, because it's a really good ability. Being able to pump all of your guys +3/+4 every turn, you know, you're going to put your opponent in a position where they just have to have blockers back, like they can't afford to attack.
And trample too, which is...
Yeah, it's just like...
You kind of misunderstand, like, hey, wait a minute, this is an overrun every turn, that's pretty good.
Right, yeah, I mean, it's very similar to Kamal Fist of Croesus' ability, except instead of paying 5 mana, you can equip it to, like, a 6/6 and just get, like, double the effect all at once. So that's all. It just feels like maybe we don't have all the information about the card.
Yeah, I will keep a link in the show notes to this very small scan part of this poster. That's why I say I can't see the rest of it to see what it's from. But if this was faked, I'm going to give them some rounds of applause. They did a fairly impressive job on this one for making a fake poster, zooming in where it looks like an actual, seems like I'm seeing the print dots, that this was actually made by a printed process. It seems well done. So the Reddit hole I went down, as I saw this, I can't remember how I clicked on the Reddit link, but apparently people are trying to put together Commander EDH decks which feature art where all the characters or the artwork features somebody sitting in a chair. And I thought that was somewhat fascinating to me.
I mean, Commander would be, what's his name? Eladamri, Lord of Leaves or whatever. Like, I'm pretty sure he's just sitting in, like, the elf throne on Wrath.
That'd be good. So this part of the question is, you know, for a lot of, you know, casual players, be it tribal, maybe commander, a lot of people play very, they're not meant to be competitive, but these very niche theme decks rock. Every single card in my deck has these letters in it or features something in the artwork or an artist. Is for you, Adam, are you aware, is there any sort of card database that lets you research cards by things featured in their art? Like, if I wanted a picture of all the cards that have a, you know, a sliver in the artwork, you know, it's not necessarily a sliver card, but a sliver in the artwork. Is there any site or service that has that? Like, how do I research cards that have people sitting in chairs in the artwork so I can make a chair sitting EDH deck?
As far as I know, that's not a thing. You know, I have some ideas of how that could be handled or implemented. You know, some are better than others, but, you know, as of right now, there's no way to search for elements of things that are in the art of Magic cards.
It feels like there had to be almost crowdsourced where people could put, you know, there's cajillions of people that have Magic card databases now for various things. They also have some sort of way of tagging where you'd give it over to the users, the players that would go through and slowly over time add in when new sets come out, like, yep, it has a chair in it. This art has a flag in it. This one, I can see people's butt cheeks in it, whatever you want to tag, and solely people can then search that.
Yeah, I mean, a tagging system would work. That would be one way to do it. I would go about it Steam's way, where it aggregates the tags from independently from multiple users, so that way you weed out the guy that just tags everything, you know.
Oh, butt cheeks. You're like, yep.
Yeah, butt cheeks. you know,
yeah, the underscore you know, stands, you can't trust his tags is everything he has butt cheeks.
Yeah, so the more people that tag something like chair, arrow, archer, stuff like that, it would aggregate together. But that's also really tedious and requires a lot of community involvement. No, and by the way, there's like almost 20,000 cards that would need to be tagged. So you're starting from scratch. You know, there's things like optical recognition where it's like looking for specific shapes or themes or color patterns that it's how Google does like their image search.
I need Watson. I need IBM's Watson. Just give it the card database. Right. It shouldn't take a very long to be like, Watson, I need cards with chairs in them. Help me out. Healthcare, no, I need to know what magic cards have chairs in them.
Yeah. But I don't think we're going to solve that problem tonight.
Yeah. And then, I mean, then intellectually, you know, say like the Throne of Bone, you know, we're going way back to Alphabet Revised. It's a chair, but it's made out of bones. Do you consider that? I mean, are thrones chairs? Or you know, how deep down this hole or how picky do you want to get?
I am not getting into this argument.
Like a stool. You know, if there's, say there's a magic card that featured a very nice bar stool, would you, because Adam, I know you're making the chair deck, would you include a magic card with a stool on it or one of those like little camping stools? You know, it has three legs, you just unfold it. Is that enough of a chair to satisfy you?
I would call that a chair.
Okay.
I mean, I'll call a bench like a chair, you know.
What if somebody's like just, you mentioned an elf before. What happens if they're just sitting in the crook of a tree? But of course, that tree is acting chair-like to that elf.
I mean, I think then the question, you know, I mean, this is like the flavor hole. I mean, at that point, the question is like,
don't tell me about your flavor hole. I didn't ask about your flavor hole.
So my question would be, is it a natural tree where the elf is just sitting on the tree? I wouldn't call that a chair. That's just like a place to sit. It'd be like a rock on the ground. Like, it's just a natural place to sit. Doesn't make it a chair. Was it trained or formed in some way? Like, is this like at like an elven watch tree where like the tree was like magically trained or cut in a way to grow into a chair?
A watch tree. That sounds like the world's boringest wall.
Right? Watch like, tree. Like, if it was made as a place to sit, like, I feel that qualifies as a chair-like quality. If it's just a natural place to sit down, it's not a chair. That's just
so basically you want, like, intelligent design. You want that some sort of intelligence has molded this object or objects into a sitting apparatus.
Yes, I want to see the hand of God.
Okay. The hand of God in your flavor hole. That's the name of the podcast. Okay, well, we got more mileage out of the cons of the Dragon Throne of Tarkir than I thought we would, so I'm excited.
Great.
And it's a Dragon Throne of Tarkir. We mentioned it. I did like its flavor text, which is what one sword high above Tarkir is now reduced to a seat. So there we go. So listeners, if you are willing to send in emails, share with me if you are off the top of your head, if you know cards that have chairs in them in their artwork, share with me because I really would like to make a commander chair deck. And then Skull lose horribly on Magic the Gathering Online. I think that's all I've got for... we do have one legendary creature, Mr. Commander, over there. Did you want to tell us about Zergo Helm Smasher?
Zergo Helm Smasher, smash. Helms.
Only helms. if you're wearing just a normal helmet, you're safe.
So this,
or if you're sitting on a chair, you're totally cool.
so this guy's kind of... I guess interesting in a I'm gonna bash you way. So he's two red, white, black. So he's a wedge, a new legendary wedge creature, but he's an orc warrior. And so what's interesting there is we haven't seen orcs. I believe there were. I don't even know if we had new ones during Planar Chaos. I think everything was goblins during Time Spiral Block. So we haven't really seen orcs since like Homelands days.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of exciting because I mean, like orcish can. I mean, there's orcish artillery. There's if you're an older player, orcs actually brassclaw orcs. Orcs actually were they were better than goblins. They seemed more exciting a lot of times.
Yeah, they there were a couple that were really kind of the staple in like the competitive red sly decks. Like just play bad red creatures that kill you before you do anything cool.
Mm-hmm.
So orcs are back, and this guy costs 5 mana. Lots very colorful, so he's not necessarily going to be the easiest guy to cast. But he's got some abilities. He has haste, so he comes down right away. He's a 7/2, so he's a 7/2 with haste for 5 mana. So that's reaching like the mono red, like ball lightning type, where like it comes down, it's cheap, and it attacks right away, but then it dies. This guy is the opposite. Zergo Helm Smasher has indestructible as long as it's your turn. So you cast him. And if he resolves, your opponent can bounce them, or take an attack from him because he's indestructible. So you might as well attack. And whenever a creature dealt damage by Zergal Helm Smasher dies this turn, put a +1/+1 counter on it. So it's a 7/2 that attacks as an indestructible in your turn. Oh, you can attack with it right away. And if an opponent chump blocks, it just gets bigger. So it's literally just like an abyss that keeps attacking.
Were you surprised? Maybe it was just from a power standpoint that he doesn't have trample. When I first read it, he had trample in my mind, and then until I saw that he did not.
I mean, I think with trample, he'd be
just too strong at that point.
As a 7/2, maybe, probably. I feel like the fact that you just have this indestructible guy that if you chump block, he just keeps getting bigger, which means like already it's 7 power. Like there pretty much isn't anything that can block and withstand a hit. You know, you need at least 8 toughness to take it. And that's assuming that there's no combat tricks or pump spells or anything else involved.
You know how you can make Zergo even better, Adam? If you sit his ass in a chair. And he starts giving all the other creatures.
And then he stops attacking and he just taps instead. And he gives all the other dudes +7/+7 to trample in turn. Yeah, that sounds like a thing that's going to make someone really unhappy.
Yeah, Zergo in a chair seems really good. The rest of my life, every creature is like, would he be better in a chair, though? And a lot of times the answer is going to be yes, he probably would be better in a chair.
Oh man, I want to make a deck that just tries to put the biggest creatures possible into the chair. Like I've got Dark Depths combo. Oh, who are you gonna attack with a 20/20? No. This Eldritch Horror, he's sitting his ass in a chair. That's what's gonna happen.
I mean, for casual players, it jumps out to me as I would love to play with this. Like, you know, some of the new creatures that you know can't attack. Say, for me, Vigian Hydropon was one of my favorite cards, Descension, which was the, you know, colors blue green. It was a 0/0 graft 5, so it came out with 5 +1/+1 counters. It was a plant mutant, because I played a lot of plant decks around this time.
It had defender and it couldn't block.
Well, it just says, oh yeah, what is it? The text is Vigian, whatever you want to say, Hydropon can't attack or block. He didn't technically have defender. It just says can't attack or block. And there's other examples of this out there, but. It seems like fun ways to use these types of creatures that are out there that if I sit this fungating mass, sit its ass in a chair, it becomes really good. And I'm trying to imagine how this thing would sit.
I know how to make this fungal pile useful. Make him king.
Make him king in a chair. And flavor-wise, do you like when we have legendary, I guess, equipment? Is that something that seems kind of cool to you, or are you annoyed when they make stuff like this? It's very expensive, so often you probably wouldn't be having one of these out running anyways, but...
I mean, legendary equipment can be cool. You know, like things like the... like I'm a big fan of like the Sword of Caldra. Just the fact that whatever creature gets hit by whatever it's equipped by, like gets exiled. You know, the ability to say, what can I equip this to that lets me do things that I usually can't do? You know, like throwing Sword of Caldra on Inferno Titan is pretty much game over for anybody trying to block, because you just literally exile up to 3 guys every turn just by pinging. Sword of Caldra's ability is pretty nice. I like it. You know, what I kind of miss about legendary is before the big shift to making planeswalkers kind of the central feature of the Magic narratives, we'd have legendary creatures like Kamal Fist of Krosa, who is the second step beyond Kamal Pit Fighter, and kind of like the evolution of a character happened. I'm not saying Kamal is like a great character to use for this example. Like I don't think his development was particularly interesting or compelling or cool, but things like Godsend, you know, Elspeth's sword on Theros or spear on Theros, that's cool. Like I get what's going on there. Like it's different. It's a colored artifact in a set that you're not expecting it in. It's not an enchantment. It does something really powerful, but it doesn't feel like it just takes over the game. Like I get what this is. Like, oh, I have Elspeth's spear. Great. I'm not quite sure like the Dragon Throne. Like I don't know enough anything about the story. So like to me, the Dragon Throne just sounds like, okay, there's just, you know, the biggest, baddest warlord sits on the throne. Got it. Like, I guess I understand it, but like if it's something that plays into the story, that pulls off of that, like, that's when I get really excited about it. Like, I don't know who Zergo Helm Smasher is. I don't know if we ever really will, if he's, like, that important of a character or not. You know, it seems like, you know, kind of like a one of the trade-offs of Commander becoming so popular, and I think this is something that people that don't like Commander point to as, like, aha, this is why Commander's so bad, is, you know, obviously design and development are producing more legendary creatures than they have before, because it supports this community that's really engaged in how they play. But I don't feel like it's always necessarily like I'm not invested in these legendary things as, you know, something special. It's just like, we got new legendary stuff to play with, but it's not like flavorfully special to me. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like, I'm kind of like a flavor guy. I like that kind of stuff. I find it interesting. So, you know, I'm a little biased, but that's my take on it.
Yeah. Like, you'd like to see this being like, taking a major magic character, like Jace, like this is Jace's throne of power or something like that, where it really plays into the kind of the ethos of the story. And potentially it might. We don't know the storyline really yet of Khans of Tarkir. Because again, you know, pretty much every creature is better if you sit in a chair.
Every creature is better in a chair.
And maybe to kind of sway, as we talked a lot about this card, is apparently this was from the September FNM poster. So it sounds like you were initially, you said, right, that maybe somebody got some promotional material and they just released it early. Sounds like the people are fairly certain that this is real.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I assume if everybody's talking about it, like there's something substantial behind it. It's just, I'm not the biggest fan of talking about cards that haven't been officially spoiled, because, you know, that one, we don't know that they're right, but also two, like, we don't know what's wrong either. But I'm peculiar. I'll admit.
I really hope it comes out, because I'm gonna be tweeting. I'm gonna be asking. I need chair art to start pulling together this deck. If I can actually play this in MTGO, for that, there's enough cards that are in its card pool. That is incredibly exciting. I've been always on the edge of trying to do some sort of streaming. This would get me into streaming if there's enough for a chair deck. Very exciting. So Adam, we're actually almost up to our hours. We're trying to keep this to an hour because we have young kids. We have to get up early. But Adam, I did want to kind of sort of end up the show, round it out. We have just a few cards that have been spoiled from the Commander 2014 set. And one of these is very controversial. And we both want to get to each other's thoughts on Planeswalkers as Commanders. I think everybody had sort of thought about it. I've heard about house rules allowing it. But now there is a Planeswalker that says right on the goddamn card, you can play this as a Commander. It doesn't even matter what this Planeswalker does. We could go through it. It's just more, do you like this idea? Is it like being stabbed in the shin bone? What does this do to a Commander lover?
So,
does it hurt the flavor hole? That's what I want to know.
I don't think it hurts the flavor hole. Actually, I think Planeswalkers as a Commander kind of makes more flavorful sense than some of the options we've gotten recently. So, I know it's a really, really interesting interaction. Anybody who's been living under a rock, we're talking about Teferi Temporal Archmage. It's 4/2 blue for Planeswalker Teferi, 5 loyalty.
I know it's actually Teferi, a Temporal Marketing Research Archmage.
Sure. And it's a 4 ability Planeswalker, but one of its abilities isn't a loyalty ability. It just says it can be played as your commander. It's got some other abilities. The +1 is look at the top 2 cards, one in your hand, the other on the bottom of your library. So, like, you do, like, the crafty Mind Mage blue thing. -1, untap up to 4 target permanents, which seems ultra broken if you've got a ton of artifact mana or lands that produce mana sources. Like, or, like, things like in conjunction with the Chain Veil, like, Chain Veil plus other mana ramp sources means you can just keep using the -1 ability over and over and ramp a boatload of mana. And it's -10 ability, which would be something I'd be stunned if I ever saw resolve in a game of Magic, which means it will happen to me and I'm going to get blown out by it, is you get an emblem with you may activate loyalty abilities of your Planeswalkers you control on any player's turn anytime you could cast an instant. So basically it does if you've ever played against Teferi, the legendary creature, basically Teferi just shuts you down and says you can only play at sorcery speed if you're the opponent to the player with Teferi.
Yeah,
and so the Planeswalker Teferi obviously flips that dynamic and says, well, your Planeswalkers now are they just do instant stuff, which which means like every single turn you can like plus one your planeswalkers and stuff. So if that ability goes off in like a Super Friends commander deck, like it's just game over, man. Because like by the time the turn comes back around to the planeswalker player, like they're probably ready to ultimate like two different walkers at that point. But flavorfully, like I get why like a planeswalker could be your general. I mean, he's literally a like an ally you call in. Like that's the idea, is like, hey, you are the person that leads my army. Like, who would you want better than like your bestest buddy with a whole bunch of loyalty on him going, hey, I'm gonna lead your army for you, dude.
Yeah, but what is your buddy in hard times? Does he sleep on your couch? Why does a fellow planeswalker need to lead your army? Why wouldn't they have their own army?
So here's the thing that I found really interesting. Which is more game breaking for commander? A planeswalker commander that's, you know, relatively expensive to cast. Six mana is nothing to sneeze at. Can't defend itself that well. You know, it can untap permanents, it can draw a card, an extra card during your turn. It's, you know, its abilities can be kind of, I think the minus one ability is obviously the most powerful, relevant one to use. But it's just a planeswalker. You can at least attack it. You can redirect burn to it. Or, two of my current commander decks leverage the gods from Theros block. So one is Mogus and the other one is Farika. And those are just basically indestructible creatures that come down early, and they're just like enchantments that don't go away. Like I get that ability for basically as long as I want. Like it's really rare those creatures get destroyed. You need pretty narrow creature answers, and you have to have the devotion where they're actually a creature. Otherwise it, you know, bosses them over. Like I feel like after having the legendary enchantment god creatures, like a planeswalker is actually like much tamer to add to the commander mix than an indestructible enchantment.
See, at least I wish they would have made like a Gideon Jura one, where at least it could turn itself into a creature and then I could sit its ass in a chair. I think that would have maybe fit me more flavorfully in my flavor hole.
I think that's going to be how somebody gets blown out by the chair and commander. Somebody's going to sit on a Gideon and like plus him a couple times, and he's going to have like an 18-18, make him a dude, equip, whoops.
I got my planes walk on the chair and I'll win. So from you, in some way, you are a big voice for a commander. So it sounds like from your side, not necessarily a terrible thing, because obviously people were screaming that the sky was falling. I admit my first, second reaction when I first read this was just kind of anger. Like, that's stupid, that's dumb. But after thinking about it for more than a couple of minutes, it, like you said, sort of step back and, you know, calm myself down, did some breathing exercises, and said, hey, if it brings more commanders, then get more people playing commander, that can't be a bad thing. And also this leverages that planeswalkers are huge for Magic as a brand now.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it seemed like they were kind of like during the panel, the implication was that these are kind of like going back and creating planeswalkers for like old planeswalkers that we loved that we don't get to see. And we won't see because, you know, they're practically all dead, because that's like a thing the old planeswalkers went through. It was just, whoops, I'm going to die sealing a temporal rift or something, whatever, by nigh omnipotent power, except for Bolas, who's like doing his Bolas thing. Ooh. But, you know, like I want to be clear, like in the greater context of what the last year has brought to Commander, I think five planeswalkers that can be commanders and were designed to be a commander up front. Like that's the thing, is like, it's not just turning all planeswalkers into commander options. It's saying these specific planeswalkers that we designed with pre-constructed decks, knowing that we're going to make them a planeswalker, are going to make them eligible commanders, our commanders, is a little different. So obviously they're going to push some boundaries, but it's going to be much safer than just like letting everybody have, Tybalt as a commander. It's probably pretty safe.
It's kind of cool for them to kind of re-explore these really classic planeswalkers that were first brought into the game as creatures, you know, before planeswalkers were even a card type. Like Teferi, you know, Timesprawl, he was a creature, legendary creature, but he was just a plain creature. So it seems kind of cool. It's a new way to kind of explore them and maybe their backstory and their powers in a way that makes sense.
Yeah. I'm really hoping we see stuff like Sarah for white. You know, Sarah was kind of the progenitor of the Sarah religions, where Sarah Angel comes from. Just a really iconic planeswalker that we didn't get to see too much of, because if you were around, the whole thing for Sarah is she fell in love with, I believe, a planeswalker named Feroz, And that's the story of Homelands, is Sarah and Farrah sealed off the plane. So that's
Farrah's ban. Okay.
Farrah's ban is what that card is meant to do. And basically it says creatures don't come in, like stay out. Planeswalkers can't summon other things in. And I think Sarah died. I'm not exactly sure how. Like, it's been a while since I've caught up on that story. Just the fact that I know some of the story of Homelands tells you how much I'm into some of the story stuff.
Did you realize that one of the bands with others, Legends Lands from Legends, was Cathedral of Sarah, is the white one?
Oh yeah, yeah. Sarah visited multiple planes. She was on Dominaria. Oh. She was on.
Why did she visit such a shitty bunch of stuff?
Yeah, like you know, she kind of did the Bolas thing, like visited place to place to place, and kind of like spread her religion behind her. So I'm hoping for like Sarah, because like I would assume like Sarah should do stuff like gain some life. Probably make angels or some sort of like cool, you know, cool, like better than Elspeth thing, but like maybe for like minus two or something. Like, I don't know. And then have like some sort of emblem that just like makes you like super defensive, you know, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what the design looks like, but like Sarah excites me. There's a bunch of old, there's like Leshrac. Leshrac?
Yeah, he was black. Yeah.
Yeah, like Leshrac was the planeswalker that betrayed Urza. So like Urza gathers all the Titans and this is the whole Yawgmoth and Phyrexes invading Dominaria, and so like Yawgmoth gathers these guys together, and like he knows Leshrac's going to betray them, and he's counting on him. Like that's part of like the how clever Urza is he knows who's going to betray him or whatever. I don't know, over the top story, but Leshrac was just like the total like cocksure like. I'm going to get you and I'm going to get what's mine. And like seeing him in a planeswalker card, like, I don't even know what that looks like, but it's gotta be like really cool. And like some sort of like, you know, like I'm going to draw a bunch of cards and pay some life for them. Like, I don't know. It just seems like there's these really cool opportunities where if these go over well, and I think they will, I think people will be excited when they see them, especially the older players that recognize these old planeswalkers. Like the fact that they could revisit this down the road and add some later or like add them to some casual set. Like, imagine if they did like a conspiracy type twist where like they revisited like old themes and like it was like a time thing. Like, what if, you know, what if we were on, you know, what if Homelands and Fallen Empires wasn't awful? What would that look like?
Oh, if you could like re-envision some of the sets and key cards. I mean, there were some amazing cards out of those sets, but if you could, I guess, redesign those sets, I guess, with their current design philosophies and viewpoint, they could make some amazing sets. That's a really cool point.
Yeah, it's like I think it opens the door to nostalgia in a way where like the really, really long veteran entrenched players get rewarded, but for everybody who's new, they get something that like they get like, oh cool, this is a planeswalker. Like I get how planeswalkers work. And then like, you know, us curmudgeons are like, well, that's not a real planeswalker because he's not nigh omnipotent. And he's this newfangled commander thing too. You know, like but it's still Teferi, because like Teferi's still a badass and people love Teferi. So, like, it's this interesting interaction, and I'm really excited to see, like, where that goes.
And it was a way to inject a little bit, I guess, sort of new blood, new excitement to the next commander set, where it could have been pretty easy to sort of stay on the same train, give you some new commander cards. Those players would get it, but it wouldn't really initially expose the format more, get new people really interested, where this might.
I mean, it also changes the value proposition. I mean, you're buying, you know, if you buy the commander decks to kind of like get cards out of for casual decks, which is something that, you know, like I buy two copies, one set of commander decks I keep together and I just grab them for random play with like friends that haven't played Magic in a while or want to play commander and we just want like random decks so we're not like kind of mismatched. But also like some people just buy the commander decks to get stuff like Soul Rings and like, you know, the dual colored lands that they need, stuff like that out of them. Like, oh, look, you get legendary creatures, but if that's not your bag, here's a powerful planeswalker too. Like the fact that it can be used to your commander doesn't preclude it from just being like a solid card for a random deck that you have elsewhere either. Like it expands what you can do with the product. Like I think it's a value add, kind of in the marketing speak.
So I will be very excited to see more of these as they come up, because we have so little, I guess, given to us yet for the commander set. I'm going to buy it anyways, but I'm excited to actually own a few more planeswalkers because they tend to be very expensive and I don't have very many of them. So, Adam, we have fully used up our hour of time. So as we wrap it up, did you want to mention any like upcoming, you know, article tournaments you're going to, events that people may be able to come and find you at, stalk you, ask you about your flavor hole, where would they find Adam, the flavor hole Staborsky?
If you want to talk to me about my flavor hole, and please do it at the top of your voice as loud as you possibly can, so everyone around looks awkwardly over at us, you'll find me at PAX probably this weekend. I assume that the podcast is going up this week. We're recording on a Sunday night.
Yeah, I should. I'll be
at PAX. Tomorrow. I'll be at PAX Prime. I'm going to the Concerto Cure party, as far as I know. So I'll be trying to do some tweets from there and talk with people, and it's always a good show. Like I haven't been to PAX Prime since the Return of Ravnica party, when they did when the lead into PAX started with the first Players Championship.
You have to just be sitting in the chair the entire time you're at that party.
I'm going to build a cardboard dragon chair, and I'm going to sit down. I'm going to be like, I give you +1/2, +1/2, and trample. Yes. And they're going to be like, what? And be like, I'm not very powerful. I'm sorry.
It's just me.
So PAX Prime, that's happening over Labor Day weekend. So I'll be rocking Seattle for a couple days before and after. The weekend after that, I'll be at Grand Prix Salt Lake City. I believe Conley's going to that as well from what I remember talking to him before. So okay. I'm excited to get out there. If you're going to be at either of those and you want to meet up or you just want to say hi, just tweet at me at the Stibs. That's the_STYBS on Twitter.
Sounds good. And I'm trying to think for me for tournaments, probably nothing come up in the near future, but I am excited to make my chair EDH deck. That seems much more exciting to me than I thought it would at the start of the show, which scares me just a slight bit.
I would strongly recommend Tom finding cards that can tutor for artifacts, because there's the cycle of artifacts from I think Magic 2013, where like the chair, the crown, and the scepter, and if you have them all out, like, they get super powerful. But there's like a chair, and like it makes something. So like that, I feel like if you don't have that triumvirate in there, like you're doing the chair thing wrong.
So that's my suggestion. You need powerful chairs. We don't want crappy chairs.
That's right. Powerful chair.
I like that. Now, I have to see if there's any like unglued or unhinged cards that have like toilets in them. That would also be kind of fun. You could explore some of the uncards for chairs as well and thrones. You know, the
I am looking forward to hearing about it when you find them.
Yes. So if you would like to send me any sort of idea for chair cards, you can send them to my Twitter is PSGReader, which is PSGReader. Or you could also tweet them just to the MTG Potpourri Twitter handle. That will make it too. Or you can email any and all of us at mtgpotpourri@gatheringmagic.com. And I did want to say thank you. I begged for a couple of emails. They gave in. They gave me some emails. So we're going to end it out with emails. Are you cool with that, Adam?
Let's do it.
I'm not sure how people read emails where they had like a smartphone with their laptop. It makes that so much easier. So I did want to say thank you to David D. I always feel like I'm going to say their whole name and maybe they don't want me to. Just says, greetings. Apparently Tom enjoys getting emails, so I'll give in and ask a couple of questions. And the subject of the email is set previews and ad cards. First off, when can we expect cons cards to start being previewed? Is it going to be early, mid, late August? I'm assuming these are officially mandated like Wizards previews. And it says, will speed versus cunning get previewed first? My second subject of questions about those ad cards are sometimes tokens or emblems. Am I the only one who keeps the ones that aren't emblems and aren't tokens? So the ones that basically advertise sometimes either sets or abilities in the set. If not, and someone else keeps these things, what do you do with them? I feel like I should be able to come up with something. I just haven't yet. So I mean, do you keep those, the non-token, non-emblem little junk cards that are in the packs?
I typically don't. Like, I'll hold on to them, like, if I'm doing a draft, because sometimes you just need random tokens and you didn't open them. I know there are people that collect them, because obviously there's, there's like a sheet, and there's only a certain number of combinations of those cards that can be printed, given like what's on the front and the back. So I know people try to collect all the different combinations and like lay out the, you know, try to figure out what the sheet might look like. So there are people that, you know, I mean, there are people that collect anything. So obviously there are people that collect these cards. Speed versus Cunning has already been fully previewed. Concerto Cures are coming up here, the end of August. So, I mean, everything's falling into line for what, you know, what I would at least typically expect for a preview season.
Okay, so sort of a typical pattern. I was trying to see if I get like an actual exact date. Oh, here we go. I'm just pulling up the actual official Wizards.com page and see if it tells me on this. Pre-release events.
Pre-release events are like what, like end of September?
Yeah, pre-release, if you're talking Paper Magic, that is September 20th to 21st.
Right, so typically the set's out. The set's known for a full week leading up to the pre-release, so previews start usually at least 2 weeks before that. I would assume that if they're going to preview a whole bunch of stuff at the Cons of Tarkir party at PAX, I mean, it sounds like we're in a timeline where previews start in like a week from now, basically. Like, okay. They'll start the Monday. They start officially the Monday after, the Monday of PAX, after the party. So I would take the party as like the start of the Cons of Tarkir spoilers, en masse.
They usually give you a big slug of previews of that. Good point. So most likely with PAX.
Yeah, and then that would probably be why, like, it seems like the timeline, like, we're short. Like, I don't think it doesn't look like we have 3 full weeks, because it would have to start tomorrow. So if they start tomorrow, great. That would be Monday, August 25th, I'm talking about. So if they start tomorrow, that's a full 3 weeks, but I'd be surprised that they didn't, like, let it sit and just have, like, a big hammer dropping on Saturday at PAX.
Okay, I like PAX. I'm now even more excited for PAX to most likely get just a whole bunch of cons information during the. Now, is this something? I mean, are you going to be tweeting during the party, or is this all stuff going? The live tweeting, live blogging is something that for old people is such a new thing that it just seems weird that you get news from events while they're happening in this sort of format.
I mean, basically, it's just going to be like a free for all. Like, the Magic players are going to come in. I'm not going to be the only one doing it. Robbie Roth
sitting in a chair, so I mean, you got both hands free.
Yeah, I'm going to both hands free in whatever chair I'm sitting in. But usually the cards are spread out all over. And so what happens is like people start coming in, they start taking pictures, and just social media just starts to blow up. And then, like, it dominates the Magic conversation that night, because people will take, the best pictures will be ones that get retweeted and that people kind of pull the images from. So I'm a big fan of Twitter, because you can embed someone's tweet, and that maintains Twitter's terms of service. So, like, unlike the newspapers that kind of gotten, like, slaps on the wrist for, like, taking somebody's image out of the tweet and just using the image, that's a no-no. You can't do that. I like sharing the tweets because, like, they can be embedded later in sites, and, like, you can look at them later and you can always revisit that tweet. But the fact that it's happening organically, like, everybody who's not there suddenly starts to see the information as people encounter it, and you get this really cool conversation going. And I think that's the big difference is, like, there's stuff like Ferguson where, like, it's the only way, like, on the ground news is getting out because of all the crazy, kind of controls over the media that local people can put into place. But for, like, a cool social event, something that's not like a very serious issue that needs to be discussed, which is what we're doing right now about our game Magic. It's one of the things where, like, you're not there at the party, but you can kind of get a sense of what's going on. You can join in the excitement because people are taking these pictures and sharing them, and you can comment them and reply to them and ask them stuff in real time. And you kind of get that involvement even though you're not there. And I think that that's what makes it so unique, is you can kind of share in it.
Awesome. And the last thing I wanted to finish on, and I'll give you a chance to also share some family stuff, Adam, but I want everybody who's listening is I want you to say happy birthday. Our youngest Lucy turns one. And when we're recording that, she is turning one tomorrow. And if you don't have kids, that means that you have all your family over. You make some sort of small cake. You cover it with a huge amount of frosting and icing. And you let that kid just demolish it on their face. And it tends to be highly entertaining because they tend to be very excited, then very, very hyper after that.
If your child doesn't almost drown in frosting, you're probably doing it wrong.
There should be more frosting than cake, because usually at that point they're not even, they have like 8 teeth anyways, and they're not really very coordinated yet with the whole taking food and putting into my food hole step, which is pretty crucial for eating. So it's just more them thrashing about and frosting just spraying everywhere. So happy birthday, Lucy. We're excited. Now, how old is your youngest now? I'm trying to think. What?
3 months.
Okay, I would have guessed 2. So it goes by really fast.
Well, I've got, that's my youngest is 3 months.
Well, that's what I mean, but that's what I was going to say.
My oldest is like 2.5 years.
Well, you're going to get to the point where they actually, as the dad, they actually can start to interact with you. Up until that point, they're basically attached like a lamprey to mom for like 26 hours a day.
It varies from kid to kid. I mean, some start smiling and doing like the social smiling right away. So, like, that's kind of interactive. My daughter, Kate, likes to like hug me and then like punch me in the nuts. And that hurts a lot. So I guess that's kind of technically interactive.
I mean, that's like a direct punch. I mean, they don't have to, like, they're not losing any force by going up or down. That's just directly into your nuts.
Yeah, it's like a Shaolin monk headbutt, like just like barrel straight in, and it's like, I'm going to destroy any chance of siblings ruining this good thing I have going on. And I'm like, too late for you.
Is she tall when you're holding her, like, and with like that one arm that if she like kicks her feet, they just perfectly hit right into the nuts?
Obviously, yeah. I mean,
yeah,
obviously.
Okay. I just kind of wonder if that was also something like genetically that they are programmed to do.
If you're an evolutionary psychologist, I am 100% sure. Like, that's easily explainable. Like, children who struck their parents in the genitalia had fewer siblings made, which means they increase their likelihood of survival, which makes no sense. Like, when you actually think about it, but like it makes sense at a surface level. So like people believe it.
Well, there's a similar article that kind of proposed that's why sort of babies tend to wake up so much at nighttime was to disrupt the sleep and basically avoid their parents procreating to have further children. Or saying, oh my God, we are never doing this again. We talked about that before. Yeah, but I just want to say it kind of fits with that, which I think is good. So between psychological and just actual straight physical trauma to the genitalia, those kids are going to win.
All right. I think we've hammered this out long enough.
Sounds good. Well, thank you everyone for listening. We are back and probably now that sort of through the, well, Adam's always pretty busy, but you had a kind of a crazy kind of month there, but hopefully things will have been normalized a little bit for all of us and we'll get back into a more regular schedule again.
So this has been Adam Staborski. I'm the_Stibs on Twitter. You can read me on Daily MTG every Thursday, writing Command Tower. I also will do a Pro Tour and Grand Prix coverage on the weekends occasionally. And I also run Gathering Magic.
And I'm Tom, and I'm sitting here. That's about all I got to share for the Magic scene.
You're sitting there giving out power and trample.
In a chair. So everybody, thank you for listening, and catch us next episode. I was about to say next week, but I can't promise that. And I always keep my promises.
That's why I never promise.
And we're done.